Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to another episode of In the Eyes of Truth. Today, back with us is the man of mystery, Christopher Hilali. And today, we will be opening up that Pandora's box to find out the mystery of who Christopher Hilali is. Many of you kept asking me for his details, and then, you know, rather than write his biography in the comment section, we decided we'll just ask the man himself. He is a man of many mysteries. Having traveled much of the world, Chris, welcome back.
Right then. Where does one relocate properly? Desert? 40 degrees? No water? Forests? Rivers? Four seasons? Desert? 40 degrees? No water? Forests? Rivers, four seasons.
It's actually much simpler than most people think.
Good Lord, that's less paperwork than a gym membership.
As a British man, I chose the place where I can still complain about the weather properly.
All right, let's head that way. Sounds good, I'm ready.
Move to Russia. Start a new life. It's easier with Moscow Connect. Website for details, moscowconnect.ru.
Hello, dear friends. Just want to remind you, if you like this video or you like what you hear, click like, subscribe if you haven't subscribed yet, send it to your friends. Let's grow this channel. Maybe we can finally hit it up to 100,000. That'd be a good round number for the summer. So let me know, leave some comments, and give a thumbs up. So look forward to seeing you in the next video. Cheers.
Thank you so much for having me, brother. It's a pleasure to be back.
So where shall we begin? So your father is a Kurd from Iran. Your mother is Greek from Greece or American born?
No, born in Canada, raised in Greece.
Okay. Born in Canada, raised in Greece. Yeah. Wow, that makes it even more complicated. So let's begin with this. Where did your parents meet? Because an Iranian Kurd and a Canadian Greek raised in Greece... That just, you know, there's the geography that usually gets in the way of meeting.
They met at a discotheque in Worcester, Massachusetts. Yes.
Okay, so she was, your mother was raised in Greece and then moved to the U.S.
So my mom, so let's go back in time. So on my grandparents' side, I know. my mom's side of the family all come from the Mani Peninsula in Greece, which is... a very historic part of Greece. It's where the ancient Spartans retreated. It's where the Ottomans were unable to really conquer. So ours was a free area in Ottoman-occupied Greece. And we had the close relationship with Russia. My ancestors were in the Russian party. They worked with the Tsars to liberate Greece. And in the early 20th century, after the war in Asia Minor and the population exchange between Greece and Turkey, my great-grandparents joined the Communist Party of Greece and started to fight for against imperialism and things like this. And then my grandparents were partisans in the Greek Communist Party and fought the Nazis and the Bulgarians and the Italians and then the Americans and the Brits who came and supported the collaborators in the Greek Civil War. After the Greek Civil War, my grandfather and grandmother went to Quebec because Quebec in Canada was more open to left-wing people who were fleeing. So either some family members and relatives went to Soviet Union, others went to other socialist states like Hungary, Albania, Yugoslavia. They took Greeks as well. And Bulgaria. Others went across to other countries that had left-wing communities or trade union movements that they were able to get in. So my grandparents went to Canada, to Quebec. There was a big Greek left-wing community there. And my mom was born there and then sent back as an infant to Greece to grow up with my great-grandparents. So she grew up in the village because my grandparents, having been in the resistance movement, they were persona non grata, basically, for decades. And we had a dictatorship. We had a monarchy, which we called monarcho-fascist, and then we had a dictatorship. After the dictatorship, things started to change for a lot of the Greeks who participated in really a continuation of the Great Patriotic War in wider Europe, where the communists were fighting, you know, supported by the Soviet Union. against the Nazis. So that's how my mom, and then my mom eventually left during the dictatorship period, went back to Canada, and then we had relatives, distant relatives in the US. So they all went down to the US. They worked, they were still active, but it was after McCarthyism, so it wasn't so bad, but we never talked politics publicly because it was very sensitive to be left wing, especially to come from, you know, the right wingers did it, like Ukrainians, the Poles, all of them, they were open. But we were very, very secret about that. You know, only at home did we play Red Army Choir and things like this and sing all the songs. And oh, yeah, it was like that. For my dad's side, of course, my dad is a Kurd in lore. So he participated in the revolution and left Iran for studying. He was accepted to University of Tehran in agriculture faculty. But as you know, in I would say global South countries, basically, once you get to university, they pick for you where you're going to go. You don't really have a choice necessarily. So my dad was like, okay, I got into the best university in the country, but they gave me agriculture. The last thing he wanted to do. He's like, I'm going to the best university to become what? A farmer, you know, to become an agricultural engineer. So he wanted to be a doctor. That was his dream, you know, to be in the medical profession. Mm-hmm. So he ended up coming to the US in the revolutionary transition period in Iran. And then they had the hostage crisis. He got stuck. Later on, he started working, met my mom, then had me. And the rest is history. But they met in the U.S. They met in the U.S. And, you know, I grew up in a very, you know, I would say progressive, revolutionary, sort of anti-imperialist household. We were always talking politics and religion at the dinner table. You know, those topics are banned for a lot of people. But those topics were the only topics that we would speak about. It was very funny when people outside of our household or outside of our circle would come and visit. And it was kind of like sometimes like awkward conversations because we didn't really know how to, you know, talk about some topics that were kind of more mainstream. And we had to kind of blend in and like, oh, the Patriots or oh, the Bruins. Meanwhile, like when everybody's gone, we're talking about, oh, the Palestinians or this one or what's going on in Cuba, you name it, right?
Well, you know, imperialism isn't just imperialism can be on the left side as well as on the right side.
Historically, of course, there's a lot of different empires and descriptions of that. Of course, in the case of my parents and, you know, my family, the criticism was always about US, EU, NATO. And I remember because I was, you know, getting to be at my early teenage years when Yugoslavia happened, it was a big deal. Everybody out for in defense of Yugoslavia, you know, this was huge. And then later on, war on terror and then Kosovo and so many things. So it was imperialism for us. You know, what happened before? OK, I was born in the 80s. You know, it was the end times of the Soviet Union. We know, of course, what happened in the Soviet Union and in other countries. But I think that even with all of the issues, you know, my family still looked nostalgically at what it represented. It represented the power of the people and the resistance against those who try to dictate terms to Russia, to other socialist countries. You see now, they're all dogs, a lot of these countries. Only Russia and China and DPRK maintain the line. But if you look
Iran,
of course, but Iran was not really socialist ever. But if you look at like Romania today, if you look at Bulgaria, they're sad, sad shadows of their past. You know,
Russia's not. The thing is, there are no socialist countries and there are no capitalist countries.
They're mixed. Everybody's mixed.
Either
stream
is an impossibility to maintain. Because if you ever talk to a libertarian, you quickly figure out that that's an impossible society. That's going to just be a revolution because it's only good for the rich.
Sure.
You know, your own police, you have to pay for it. Well, so everybody else gets to be, you know, your own fire department, you have to pay for it yourself. That's an impossible society.
No, for sure. I totally hear you. Of course, there are mixes. They bring in some of this instrument, some of that, some of this ideology, some of that. But in any case, I think the bigger issue today is sovereignty and the question of people respecting sovereignty. And still for the Europeans, for the U.S. historically, and for other NATO countries, and even in the region like Israel and other. Allies and proxies, they don't respect sovereignty.
You see, if we work at this, I think I could make you into a mercantilist.
Into a mercantilist. I thought you would say a monarchist. I said,
wait a minute, monarchist, there's a socialist monarchy called North Korea. Seriously, what's a monarchy? It's hereditary rule. Grandfather, father, son. North Korea. That's not a monarchy.
Well, we wouldn't describe it as a monarchy because they were popularly elected. But wow. I mean, some commentators say it's a monarchy. Yes, that's
look,
true.
You know, Assad was a monarch. You know, his father was there for. They have elections. Okay, fine. you know, Azerbaijan is a monarchy. Second generation.
Family.
Yeah. You know, it's the same people for life. Okay, so they go through this courting process. You know, once every 4 or 5 years, we have a election. But there's nothing wrong with a monarchy if, as long as it takes care of the people.
That's it. I know that you are a fan.
Well, you know, the people they want to put into Iran as a quote monarchy is not a monarchy. Because
no, look, God knows.
Look, you know, if you got a republic and you have a monarchy, those two governments tend to be nationalistic. You know, our resources kind of belong to us. You know, as opposed to, you know, the U.S. will set up whatever, they'll call it whatever, but it's really just a junta. That says, you know, keep us in power and we'll give you everything.
Yeah, that's true. It's true.
Yeah.
It's true. So for me, you know, I grew up in that kind of environment and that shaped me. And especially the war after 9/11.
Oh, yeah.
War is a plural. And all that transpired from Afghanistan to Iraq, Libya, Syria, so-called Arab Spring, all that had a big impact on me, especially
so
politically.
Your entire life, what year did you grow up?
What year was I born?
Yeah, what year were you born?
88.
88. So, let's see. We had Panama was in, what, 91, I think?
With Noriega.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, it was Bush Senior, wasn't it?
Yeah. Yeah. So, and then there's Grenada, but that was a bit later. So basically, you've only had about, out of your entire life, about 3 or 4 years where the U.S. wasn't at war.
Yeah.
In an active war somewhere.
Yeah.
We had Somalia, you know, if you count all that. So, yeah.
Yeah, of course. And listen, the U.S. being at war is,
status quo.
Part of the DNA. It's part of, like, how I grew up. Like, the U.S. was always at war, you know?
Yeah.
And, you know, I was very critical. And of course, in my young years, I was idealistic. I said, okay, maybe, you know, okay, I need money for school, number one. Number two, maybe I can change it from within. Maybe, you know, something's possible. So I ended up joining ROTC, first in the Air Force. Then I switched to the Army, which was crazy because usually people go from the Army to the Air Force.
Yes.
And I went from the Air Force or Chair Force. I went from the Air Force to the Army. And people were like, wait, what? You want to do blue to green? It's usually green to blue.
Yep.
And I said, no, I want to go to the Army. And they're like, okay, are you sure? Are you sure? Sure. So yeah. So ended up going into the Army. I was commissioned in 2011 as an infantry officer, did my airborne school, did all of that. And then, you know, basically as I got up, it became apparent that I was going to be deployed probably to Afghanistan. I was like, I don't really like that idea because I don't really support this. And by 2011, by 2002-03, everybody knew what was going to come.
Oh yeah.
By 2011, I mean, the writing was clear for everybody. You had to be a propagandist to not believe, you know, the reality on the ground. And the reality was that the Taliban maintained command and control over large swaths of the country, and that the U.S. was in the process of nation building, a country that wasn't yet prepared or wasn't really interested in the nation that the U.S. wanted to create there.
Afghanistan has never been really a nation. It's more like a bunch of different clans living in a land called Afghanistan.
Correct. So that land, and of course that land had been part of, there'd been historic empires. Either it was the Safavids or the Qajar,
right.
From the northern part, the southern part, the Mongols, the Turkic people. So it was all mixed.
Even the Chinese.
Even the Chinese, of course. Yeah. You know. So I think that when you understand that, I was like, first of all, I'm going to go there as an Iranian American. And they wanted me to do, you know, because they're like, okay, you're Iranian background. So Persian speaking, perfect. Dari, there you go. It's Afghanistan. I'm like, okay, but you understand that if I go there, they're going to see me, but I'm also going to be a target because they're like, well, he's kind of one of us and he's on their side.
Yep,
so I'm like, no, I'm going to be like the number one guy to hit. And they're like, I mean, it comes with the territory. And I'm like, so you want me to go there, you want me to do this job on a war that I don't believe, And you really don't have any clue as to how this is going to end, even though we know how this is going to end.
Oh, yeah.
So I just said, you guys, I'm, you know, I had a, you know, come to Jesus moment. I'm going to seminary. And they're like, all right, for God and country. So I switched from the infantry to the chaplain corps, did my seminary training, and then resigned my commission.
So did you finished seminary, Orthodox seminary?
Yeah.
So, but you were never ordained a priest, or were you?
I was not. I was ordained a reader, but I was never ordained into the diaconate and then into the priesthood. No, I could be if I wanted to, and I could choose it like that. But for me, it's a very serious decision, and I'm, you know, yeah. It's so, you know, it's not something decision. Light. It's not
absolutely.
Something.
Absolutely, and it's sure. The best, as they said, you know, the best place to find a husband for a single woman is seminary.
There you go.
But those don't understand it. Orthodox priests are actually not allowed to be married. They can enter the service married, but they cannot get
right.
married once they're a priest.
Right.
They
you can't
be married. They can enter as a married man and be a married priest. They can't
Correct.
Remarry and they can't marry during their service.
Correct.
So, yeah. So they get desperate.
Correct. And also I had another conundrum, which was that my father is Shia Muslim, and I grew up in between two religious traditions. So yes, I was baptized Orthodox Christian, but I also, you know, I would go to mosque with my dad. I knew all about Shia Islam. And, you know, for me, I was at seminary, and they were like, well, you can't, according to the canons of the church, you can't be a priest if your parents are not fully Christian. I said, first of all, that's bogus, because the early Christians, not all of them were like that. But there are some canons that are, you know, there are some canons that...
Is there such a canon? Wait a minute. Is there seriously such a canon?
Yeah, there's a canon. I'm trying to remember which one. I'll find it for you because it's in the Pedaleon. But
because, yeah, you're right. A lot of the saints, they had pagan parents.
Yeah, of course they did. But they're like...
Almost all the apostles had pagan parents.
Well, for sure. For sure. I mean, many people. I mean, people were killed by their parents. There were saints that were killed by their parents.
Absolutely.
Or relatives. So for me, it was a problem for me that they would be treated that way, that I would be treated that way simply for the faith that, you know, my family held. So in that
you
way,
don't
I also
answer for your parents, though. You're not supposed to answer for your parents. You're only supposed to answer for yourself.
Theoretically, you're absolutely right. But that was a problem. So it was a big problem for me in seminary, and it was a constant. Listen, for me as a kid, I was always, you know, trying to figure out, is my mom saved? Is my dad saved? Are they both saved? Are none of us saved? So I'd go to the priest and say, well, my dad is not Christian and he's not baptized or chrismated. Is salvation possible for him? And some priests would be like, no, he's going to hell. And I'd be like, but I love my dad. I don't want him to go to hell. And then they're like, well, you have to baptize him. And I'm like, but he's happy where he is. You know, he comes to church. He just doesn't want to be baptized. They're like, yeah, he's gonna burn. So I was like, okay, well, don't like that priest. Then I went to you know, I went to other people, and like the sheikh was like, oh, okay, well, your mom is a woman of the book. So, you know, Allah has mercy and this and that. But, you know, as a kid coming to from a multi-religious family was complex. So from the start, I had to navigate difference.
Yep.
I'm half Iranian.
At the end of the day, you know, while all things considered, at the end of the day, at least as I was taught, it's still God that chooses. So
for sure.
It's his
for
choice,
sure.
not yours. And
for
not,
sure.
No priest or imam or whomever else can say for sure.
No, of course not. It's
hand.
A mystery.
Right.
It's a mystery, and I leave it. It's, you know, in God's benevolence and love for humanity, I mean, I think I know where he would go on a lot of issues, but it's up to him. But you understand that for younger people, this is a big concern. And also, if I think about Russia is a country that has Orthodox Christians, Muslims, Buddhists, you know, other minorities,
Romans,
has Jews.
Catholics.
Yeah, of course. Catholics, of course. So for me, are all of these heroic people who are fighting on the front lines or who have fought for Russia over the years, is God not going to look favorably on them because they weren't baptized or the right way or didn't see? I don't know. It's just for me, it always struck me as a little bit, I don't know. It was a little bit too restrictive when people would be like, only us. And not only that, only the ones who follow our guy is like that. Like, if you're not in communion with the patriarch in Constantinople, you aren't saved. I said, why not? Who said? Where does it say? You know,
the patriarch of Constantinople lately has been a heretic from hell.
Well, there you go. He's a CIA agent, you know.
Oh, yeah. Unfortunately. Unfortunately, Ukraine and everything that going in somebody else's canonical zone, which has no,
that's right.
no right to do.
That's right. And so he ended up, you know, trying, he broke centuries of tradition, you know, and he divided a people who are together, who are family, really. Slavic brothers, you know. So
one race,
really, at the end of the day, really. Yeah. So when you look at that and you understand that, that's part of how I was grew up in this firmament. And that kind of made me who I am as a person, which is why living in Russia now, it's so nice because it has flavors of all of these things. And I feel very much at home in that way. You see.
So, once you left the U.S. military, though, because you went to Syria.
Correct.
To join Correct. The Kurds.
Correct. So after that,
How
I left.
How did that happen?
I left the U.S. military in the fall of 2015. Mm-hmm. In the spring of 2016, I finished seminary. And immediately I left for Greece to start working with refugees. Because there were the big refugee crisis.
Right, right.
And I started working heavily in the Kurdish community. Got involved. Lived in an area where there were a lot of refugees. I housed refugees in my own apartment. From Afghanistan and from Syria. And eventually, after seeing what was going on there and the fighting, first in Kobani, then in Membij and all these places, I said, you know, first of all, the Kurds that were there, who many of them were from the PKK, were like, you have an obligation as a Kurd to fight for our people. And I was like, okay, you make a good point. And then they were like, you're trained to fight. So that's even more incentive. I was like, okay, good point. And then they were like, okay, this is the way to go. And so I said, okay, I'm going to go fight. So I ended up, this was a conflict I could believe in, right? This was a war I believed in because we were fighting an enemy that was brutalizing and massacring all of our people and all of the minorities and all of the people in the region at the behest of the US and Israel and NATO and Turkey and the Gulf states. So I said, fuck them, I'm going. Plus the Russians were there. I supported Assad. The Iranians were there. Everybody was there. Hezbollah was there. Everybody was there fighting. SSMP, communists. It was a whole big alliance of groups. So I went. I went in January 2017. I got to Sulaymaniyah in Iraq, crossed the border. At first, I spent time in the PKK camps, which were, by the way, being drone attacked at that time, a decade ago. They were using the original Bayraktar kind of drones, the first generation. And they were attacking PKK camps and things like that. So we went secret. We had to be very careful. We had to be cognizant of all that stuff. We crossed the border into Syria. I did my training at the YPG International Academy. Mm-hmm. And then I went off to with a Turkish communist group, which had as a commander a very famous Armenian, Nubar Ozanian, who went by different names, different noms de guerre. But he was an unbelievable man. He fought in Nagorno-Karabakh. He was he was with Monty Melkonian in the fight against Azerbaijan in the 1990s. He fought against Israel with the Palestinians. And then he was a big fighter. He spoke Russian, by the way.
If he grew up in the Soviet Union, of course he'd speak Russian.
No, he was an Armenian from Turkey, but he had a lot of connections with Soviet Union. Turkey, he learned from the Soviet Union. He went, trained, all this stuff. He used to tell me about some things. He taught me a lot of technical skills that are very dangerous for the Americans. Of course, when I came back to the U.S., they're like, we know you know this information because they had their spies over there. But they said, you can have this knowledge.
But like they're going to get it out of your head.
Yeah, but they're like, no, you can have this knowledge. It's not illegal to have this knowledge. But if you cross that boundary of then implementing that knowledge into reality, we're going to come down on you like a ton of bricks. And I'm like, okay, thank you very much for the information. So anyway,
we need to discuss some of this sometime.
Yes, for sure we will. So anyway, he used to joke with me. He used to say, this is a Soviet formula. And he would wink at me. And I'd be like, from our comrades, Tavarish. So in any way, so I had that kind of training. And then I went and fought on the front lines for about 4 months. I was injured in the Raqqa campaign. And a lot of friends were martyred. But it was at that time, so while I was in Syria, I was coordinating and working because I had a leadership position. I was assistant commander in the International Freedom Battalion. But in the kind of makeup of all the groups, where I had some coordination with our Russian comrades, with our Russian brothers in Wagner, with the Syrian Arab Army, with the different Christian groups that were there fighting. So there was a lot. There was a lot going on.
Were you there when the U.S. murdered 300 Wagner fighters or
No, that came after.
Yeah.
That came after. That was a big...
That. Nobody in Russia's for, you know, Russia hasn't forgotten that. Fighting Islamic jihadists, and the U.S. brought in, hit them from a long way off with standoff missiles. Aviation.
Yes.
While
yes.
they were chasing down Islamic jihadists.
Yes. And none of my friends forget that, of course.
Yeah.
None of my friends and brothers.
Betrayal here. Right there.
It's a big betrayal. I mean, the whole thing was a betrayal. And I worked very hard, tirelessly, to work with the Kurdish leadership that the alliance with Russia and Assad was necessary and was essential for Syria's long-term stability.
Yep.
But in the end, in the fall of 2017, I left because the U.S. got more entrenched and they pushed us out. All the pro-Russian elements of the YPG were eventually just kind of pushed out. The PKK had this division with the YPG, and the YPG had to play the American card oftentimes. And what ended up...
It cost them a lot to play that American card.
It cost them everything because in Afrin, some of our colleagues went who... Those who wanted to stay with Russia went to Afrin, which was separated by the Turks and their jihadist forces. Right. They took them there. And then when the PKK and the YPG decided against basically forming an alliance with the Russians and with Assad, the Russians withdrew their peacekeeping forces and military from Afrin. The Turks came in and massacred everybody and took over the whole area. It's under, you know, Turkish jihadist occupation since that time. So all this to say that I saw front and center, number one, how important it was, the relationship with Russia, especially in the region, and how Russia was contributing to defeating jihadists, because there were a lot of Chechens in ISIS. There were a lot of people from Caucasus in ISIS. They were the ones who were against the government. They were ones who were against Kadyrov. They were ones who had their own vision. They were the exile. They were the community. But there are some people who left Russia, who left these places and went there. So Russia knew that this was an existential crisis for them. Just like China knows that the Uyghurs, the East Turkestan Islamic Party and their militants in Syria, which number thousands, are an existential threat for the Chinese.
Absolutely.
For all of us. So I left Syria, went back to the US. I finished some schooling. COVID came. And I worked at that time. I was very active. Let me just preface by saying from 2014 onwards, I was very active in Donbass support. Very active. It was actually a toss up where I would go, because in 2016, I had the decision to go to Donbass or to Syria. But at that time in Donbass, we had Minsk 1 and 2 that were coming into play. So there was really no participation. I was in contact with Texas and a bunch of other guys there, Spaniards and Italians who were going back and forth. And eventually it was like, okay, well, there's no fighting there. If I go there, I'm just going to sit in a base and just kind of hang out. I want to be in the fight. So we supported them. We were doing a lot of solidarity work. And actually, there was some cross solidarity for 2 years or so between the Donbass and the YPG fighters. And then that kind of got muddled because some of the YPG fighters were from Azov as well. We had some internal conflicts. I've written about
really?
This.
Really? Yeah.
Yes.
YPG fighters from Azov?
Yes, I've written.
Azov is now. I mean, all the Ukrainian Nazis are now big into arming Islamic jihadists around the world.
Listen to this. The early instances of people coming for political reasons was left wing, but there were right wing that came. Why? Because the Kurds are Aryan in the formula, in the common kind of racist formula. Kurds and Iranians fall under the Eastern Aryan category for like Nazi race science. So many people who were in Azov or Pravi sector or these groups that fought from 2014 onwards, they then came to Syria and said, we want to defend our Aryan brothers against the Arabs and the Muslims. Yes, we had a huge fight. Oh, there was one guy in my unit. He eventually was killed and he's labeled a martyr by the PKK. I've written against this, by the way. I said, this is absolutely against all of our principles that we would label this guy a martyr when he butchered Russian civilians. But he was affiliated with Azov. He fought in the Donbass. And then he came to Syria and fought. Oh, it was bad. It was bad. And there are people who were in Syria who ended up going to Ukraine to continue the fight because they probably were agents of the West. So for example, we have some famous ones. Aiden, the one from that side, was Cossack Gundi. That guy, he was in Syria. I saw him there. Of course, I was interacted with him. He went to Ukraine and fought in Ukraine. He married a Ukrainian. He became a Ukrainian citizen. And now you saw he was part of the prisoner exchange. He was captured, but he was sent out. What's his name? I'm trying to remember his name. I can see his face. The other British guy. There are two British guys that were very famous that were captured by...
Oh, yeah, they both did not get executed. They got mercy, and now they're both... you see, the Russians are spineless. They didn't shoot us.
Exactly.
Freaking moron. Quite seriously, they should have put them on their knees and popped them at that point.
Exactly. And those are the people that were in Syria with me. And I unraveled a situation, a criminal conspiracy. They were in charge of a medical unit. They were stealing tramadol and using it and selling it. This was for battlefield injuries.
Oh, yeah.
For people getting legs blown off from IEDs and VPATs.
It's a morphine drug.
Yes.
So, yeah.
And they were using it and selling it. And so I helped to uncover the tramadol trade. I went undercover for the PKK leadership. I wrote a huge report. They got a slap on the wrist.
Yeah, these guys, which is funny, you know, you get this in the Nazi race theory where half the white race, which happens to be Slavs, are considered subhumans.
Subhuman.
Yeah. We are the dominant portion of the white race, if we're going to call it a white race. And these guys, you know, well, these guys were English. But these, the ones that the Azov guys, especially the Slavic ones, I mean, you're still a Slav. You're at the end of the day, you're a Russian, whether you like it or not.
Yeah.
And Azov was created by whom? Kalamovsky.
Kalamovsky, that's right.
Kalamovsky is a who?
Is he what I think?
Come on. Yeah, you can say it.
Is he a Jew?
Yes, he is.
There you go.
He's sitting in jail right now because his protege and jester Zelensky put him in jail. But he's also a citizen, dual citizen of
Israel.
And did Israel take away his citizenship for starting an all-out SS? Well, at that point it was a battalion. Now it's a corps.
They probably gave him a promotion.
He did. He was a rich Jewish guy, dual citizenship, Israel. That's right. They, you know, Mr. We are against the Nazis, who have no problem with people that started armed Nazis, flat out Nazis.
No, they're like the Judenrat. Yeah. They support. They're part of the structure, you know.
Well, yeah, what did Merz say? Israel is doing our civilizational dirty work.
Yeah,
committing genocide.
Yes.
So what's changed in the West? Nothing's changed in the West.
Not much. Not much has changed.
So you came back to the U.S. I know you used to be married, and I've seen photos of you with like that much hair. You know.
Oh yeah, I used to have long hair. Yes, and a big beard.
Yes, you did have the big beard and a long hair.
I had that big beard.
You look like you belong on Mount Athos.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. Either Mount Athos or Tora Bora. So it depended on, you know, where people wanted to place me. But yes, I came back, finished graduate school. I was a teacher, high school teacher for a few years. I loved that. I was teaching history. And in 2020, before when the pandemic kicked off, I was invited to go to Lugansk. I was supposed to go to Lugansk for a big anti-fascist conference. Mm-hmm. It got canceled, but... once things opened up again, I came to Russia. I did the World Youth Festival in 2024 in February in Sochi, February, March, and then went to Donbass in 2024 summer, reported on it for the UN, started to get really involved. And in 2025 in April, I came over to Russia, and I've been pretty much here ever since. I was elected in November 2024 as High Bailiff of Orange County, Vermont. So
tell me about that. And why Vermont? I mean, where did you teach?
I went to graduate school at Dartmouth College, which is on the border of Vermont and New Hampshire. So it's in Hanover, New Hampshire. And I met my my ex-wife at the time there, and she had a farm in Vermont. So we ended up moving in and expanding the farm and doing all kinds of great work. And it was fantastic. You know, had two amazing kids together. And we're very close. I mean, the situation with me now is complex with the political situation in the US, because even as a journalist and even as someone who is reporting, there's a lot of repression for those who have provided humanitarian aid and support to the Donbass, for those who have
Yes.
traveled to the Middle East reporting on the truth in Lebanon, in Yemen, in Iran, in Iraq, and elsewhere. So, I think the US is not the safest place for me to travel to at this point. But in any case, I maintain a lot of links and ties with the US, family there, work there, and yeah, we just continue on with our work and efforts as we normally do.
You know John Varoli?
Yes, of course,
Yeah,
friend.
he had to leave the US because he used to be he's a former journalist,
Yes.
and he had to leave because he supported Russia in all this, and the FBI didn't like that.
No.
But he didn't have that much of a voice, but they still came down on him.
Yeah.
Didn't they raid your? You were saying once they raided your ex-wife's house.
Yeah, they've been to some family members' houses. They've been to they first raided me in 2013, and when I was going to China, and afterwards it's been nonstop. Every time I crossed the border, I was detained. My electronics were seized. I went through some very humiliating moments in some of those detentions because they can keep you for up to 24 hours. So I've been kept near that kind of time, like a full day.
When so wait a minute, the first time they raided you was when you went to China.
Yeah.
What was this is 2013. What
Yes.
was the basis of raiding you for going to China? I mean, my God, every other American businessman was going to China.
Correct. So I had been granted a China government scholar for Sino-US cultural communication, and I was studying Marxist philosophy. So when I went to the airport, or before I went to the airport, the FBI did a raid on, and this was after the Boston Marathon bombing, to give you
Okay.
context. So the FBI, on intelligence that they have, who knows, they raided my grandfather's house, my parents, they went to my professors, my teachers, everybody. And they were looking for weapons. They were looking for
Well,
weapons
legal
and
weapons or illegal weapons?
illegal. They thought that I don't know, whatever kind of bomb making factory there. Who knows? They thought I was, doing intelligence for the Chinese. They literally would not. I had to go to FBI headquarters in Boston in person, and I had to discuss with them what I was going to do in China. And I said, "Guys, I'm going for graduate school. I'm going to study Marxist philosophy. There's nothing illegal about that. There's nothing illegal about
So,
that."
so, so
And they
a
were.
teacher in Vermont living on a farm, and they're afraid of what?
They're afraid of everything, They're afraid of everything,
You're gonna lead the Vermont communist movement to topple farmers
There you
and
go.
milkmaids to do what? Topple Washington?
Listen, I'm leading the Second Vermont Republic. So, for those who don't know, Vermont was a republic before it became the 14th state. So, that's it. We're going to do the Second Republic. We're breaking away.
Well, first we're going to get the Confederacy up and running.
Yes,
Then
listen, the
the
Confederacy.
Yankees can do whatever the hell you want up there.
Exactly, guys, So it was crazy. It was crazy. I faced a lot of repression in that way and a lot of issues.
Huh.
And when I
This is
went,
2013. You can't say this
yeah.
is, God, this is even before Ukraine fully flipped, before they were able to flip Ukraine fully.
I know. I'm an old one for the list.
Wow.
I'm an oldie, but a goodie for them on the list. So 2013 came, 2014 in China. Also, I visited the DPRK. That was a big deal for them as
Ooh.
well.
Wait a minute, you're not supposed to do that? You're not supposed to do that, as far as I remember. That's against the law in the US.
It's now against the law. It wasn't back then.
Oh, okay.
It wasn't back then. So I could, and I did, and I had no, but when I came back to the US, oof, hours of questioning. I said, look, it's my right. I have every right to go there. In any case, the situation became so untenable, and it became untenable both under Democrats and Republicans. It wasn't like it was one party good, one party bad. This was the deeper structure of the US government, which is very much against Russia, against China, against Iran, against everybody. You know that. So there's no, there's, I think a lot of people have kind of, no, I wouldn't say myopic kind of vision, but they don't understand. They have a kind of idea that somehow it's just the top politicians, and then if we get rid of those or if we change them, everything's going to be pro-Russia, pro-China. No, no, no. It's much deeper than that. All these people are trained from school, and you are a product of American education. I am as well. From schooling, Russia bad, China bad, Iran bad, these Arabs bad, these Latin Americans, bunch of migrants and whoever, whatever. So all of this stuff.
Yeah, yeah. New week, Stoss is another fight. I remember my childhood.
Yeah,
well,
yeah.
Maybe not every week, but every 2 or 3 weeks, I was definitely in a fight.
There you go. You know, oh, he's from that place, you know, F them, the evil empire, a bunch of drunks and hookers and things like that. They had no idea about the history.
No.
You ask them about Catherine the Great, Peter the Great, you know, all these people, go back and talk about the time when, you know, Alexander Nevsky was fighting all these groups that were coming there, saving Europe, back and forth. They knew nothing, nothing, zero, yep. Zero.
Better dead than red. Heard that more than once in my life.
Of course. I heard the sand N-word for me all the time. I heard everything, you know. I was a towel head, Haji. I heard it all.
You know, it's funny too. My mother, my mother was teaching Russian in the Charlotte Community College. And I mean, this is mid-80s. And she comes back, like one of the first times she was teaching. So this old woman walks up to her after class. It's like, are you Russian? She's like, yeah, you can't be. I'm like, why? You're not red. I mean, that's the level of understanding. Your skin's white. Yeah, we're white Russians. don't tell them that it used to be a side that was called Black Russians, the anarchists, the Green Russians, the different agrarian groups. Yeah, they go, you know,
they have no clue.
They lost their mind.
They lost their minds.
That's the level people understood things. Oh, red Russians means you're literally a red person.
Yeah.
You know, red skin, you know, you probably have beady red eyes, you know, little fangs hanging out there, little horns.
Yeah, that's what they really, I mean, this caricature was there. So, you know, after a period of time, I'll tell you, working in the U.S. as a teacher, a lot of people very, very angry with my Russophilia, or saying that Russia was a great civilization, a great European country, one of the strongest, saved Europe multiple times, not just once.
Yep.
So, but I got a lot of pushback. I got a lot of pushback, even for talking about the Great Patriotic War and the Soviet contribution, pushback.
Listen, I had a friend, one of my fraternity brothers, actually, he was a history major. And when I said to him, you know, the majority of the Nazis, I'm not going to say Germans, I'm saying Nazis, because most of Europe was Nazi, in that European, new European order, a.k.a. EU 1.0, died on the Eastern Front. And he just starts laughing. No, we did. We killed most of them. Like, no. But this is what he was being taught at NC State in the history department.
Yeah. Isn't that sad?
Oh, yeah. I mean, this isn't even, you know, some village high school. This is forget at the university, and they're talking about that.
Yeah, of course. I got asked why in a video I called Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov Your Excellency, and I had to explain to my colleagues who were educated in fine institutions in the U.S. that Your Excellency is diplomatic language for a foreign minister. Like, when you refer to a foreign minister, you call him Your Excellency, just like you call someone Your Eminence or the Honorable for a judge. Yes.
Or the Honorable for an Israeli-owned senator or congressman. I don't know how much honor is in there, but definitely. You know.
There you go. So that's a little bit my background. Now I'm here in Russia, you know, set up shop here. And everything is good, you know, doing journalism. Doing a lot of our great activities, doing academic and research work, and loving it. You know, love hanging out with you as much as possible.
Oh, yeah. We had a couple good beers, and we'll have some more. did you get political refugee status?
Here?
Yeah.
No. It's not necessary in my situation.
Okay, good. Because, no. You know, I know plenty of people from the U.S. and other countries. You know Chris Sims?
Yes, of course.
You know his story? I actually did an interview with him on that. The U.S., the FBI wants him because
Correct. He
was doing a speech on cryptocurrency as a Brit, as a friggin' Brit, right, has no laws against Brits going to North Korea. And the other guy right before him was doing a speech was an American who wasn't allowed to be there, but he self-identified in South Korea to the American embassy, dumbass. And they're like, oh, co-conspirator. And the British government was just going to hand him over. So he's broken no laws of England, yeah, right? He's broken no laws, U.S. laws on U.S. territory, but they're extraditionary laws. They want him, so they're, the FBI was demanding he turn himself over.
Yeah.
That's insane. Yeah, I mean,
he's a good friend. He's a good yeah. friend, and what he's been through has been hell, really.
Yeah, that tells you. I mean, just the level of insanity, and the, by the way, the British government are a bunch of lab dogs that won't even defend their own citizens.
Well, think about this: we have our beloved George Galloway.
Yes.
You know how many times? So over 30 years in Parliament.
Yep.
Won multiple elections, multiple parties. And he right now is in self-imposed exile because of an active court case against his wife for crimes we don't even know about. There's been no charges. There's been nothing. But this is a political attack on the leader of an up-and-coming party that challenges the duopoly there, the Labour and the Tory duopoly, and provides an alternative, the Workers' Party of Britain, which is once no to NATO, no support for Ukraine, you know, advocates for Palestinian rights, and you see where, and it advocates for peace with Russia, peace with China, but you see it's become a threat. It's become a threat because he's so big, his show, yep. so big, and it's become a threat. And now, you know, he's also between here and China and Indonesia and Malaysia, and he's, you know, with a suitcase always in hand. But you see, that's yep. what that's. Yep. That's the, and he was a member of parliament, not once, not
years a member of parliament. Was he head of Labour in his own time?
No, not head of Labour, but he was a very prominent member of Labour Party.
Yeah, and that, no, I know he's head of a registered party. That's yeah. so that yeah, that's and he was charged with they're trying to charge him with terrorism and sedition.
That's
he was
crazy.
Coming back from Russia when he got he wasn't arrested; he was restrained.
Yes.
Which means no, you get no advocate. You get no rights because you're not really, you're not arrested. You're restrained. Kind of love that.
And he was coming back. I had seen him. We were together. He was coming back from the World Youth Festival. The World Youth Festival in Nizhny Novgorod we were at. And he was speaking. He was a keynote speaker to talk to the youth about peace, diplomacy, his life, his experiences.
Oh, God forbid peace breaks out. There's no money in that.
No, but we don't want peace for the most part.
You know, whether it's so-called left or so-called right, you know, Tories or Labour, the problem you get in both is they're globalists.
Yeah.
So there yeah. really is no difference between them.
Yeah, you're right. I mean, what difference? I mean, the same we say Democrats and Republicans, they all go to the same bars, they all go to the same country clubs, they all... Love this. They all go to the same trips to Israel.
Yeah, whenever Israel goes. And 250 yeah. members, half of Congress runs over for a group really? Photo under Israeli flags. Man, you can't make this crap up.
Not only that, Netanyahu comes to the U.S., doesn't even meet with the president of the U.S., goes straight to Congress, delivers a speech, and leaves without saying hello to the president.
And how many ovations, standing ovations, did he get?
The whole time they were standing, basically.
Like, there's like 40 standing ovations. This is like something out of the Soviet Union back in the 1920s when the radicalism was there. And they'd clap on some of these meetings so they were ready to pass out because they were afraid to first one up. This is the same level. But at least they're clapping, you know, in the Soviet Union, they're clapping for their own people. This is a foreigner that's come in there. And you're, well, a foreign owner of the yeah. U.S. that's come in
yeah,
there.
Yeah, you're right.
It's insane.
Crazy.
You know, the Republican primaries, where every second flag is an Israeli flag. Yeah, and the MAGA people, the real MAGA people, not the groupies that are left in MAGA, the people that voted for end of wars, take care of our own issues, the localists, the nationalists, the patriots, whatever you want to call them, you know, that came in there and went, what the hell?
You know, wait a minute. What is this? We yeah. didn't vote for this.
That's insane. That's absolutely insane.
I agree with you. 100%.
But that's the reality. Oh, yeah. So I guess with Massey being gone and Marjorie Taylor Greene being gone, Who's left as prominent Republicans? Rand Paul.
Rand Paul.
Can you think of anybody else?
As a prominent like vocal critic?
Yeah. Or just not on the Israeli payroll.
No. Everybody else is give or take close and proximate to the Israeli payroll.
So would it be too far from the truth to say that the Republican Party should be labeled as a foreign agent organization?
Both the Republicans and Democrats should have that label.
The Democrats are 80%. The Republicans are about 100% now. I mean, the Democrats have got a little bit of a ways to go.
It's sad.
Part one's complete. Now we refocus on part two.
But you got to imagine that they are against the national interests of their own people. Like, they are literally serving a foreign, hostile actor that is bringing our country into ruin. If you think about it.
Just for the non-American audience, because probably half my audience is actually Americans. But for the non-American audience, remind me again about the American free health options.
Crickets.
But Israel has free health.
For sure.
Yeah, baby. Remind me about the free universities in America.
Don't have.
Israel has free universities paid by
American taxpayers.
Well, not only. The Europeans pay their share, a small share there.
Well, for sure. Everybody's got to contribute.
Speaking of contributing, I know we've been on for a while, so let's finish up with the last topic of the prominent topic. The other psychopathic Nazis, the Ukrainians struck. I'm ad hocking this, but it flows so well because truth is the truth. The Ukrainians I'm from Lugansk, so this is not Lugansk city itself, but this is in the Lugansk province. They struck a dorm for a local teaching university. Four drones. So they had recon drones, and then they brought in four drones. The majority of people, these are freshmen, the majority of people there were 17, 16, 17. So these are children. 40 wounded, four dead at least. They're still unraveling the rubble. Five-story building, the top three stories collapse onto the second story. And what can you say to that? What can you say to those that sponsor that?
I mean, first and foremost, I send my condolences and sympathies, to the families and the friends and the community members who lost loved ones and memory eternal. To those who were killed, those who were martyred, really. Because, listen, at the end of the day, the Ukrainians cannot do these kinds of actions without support from their Western sponsors. Absolutely. Ukraine exists now as a Trojan horse of the West. And the sad part is that, many don't want to see the truth, which is that the United States continues to arm and support with intelligence, with military technical details, the Ukrainian forces, as do the Europeans, as do other countries, including Israel. They all provide weapons. They provide technicians. They provide experts. There are attachés in Ukraine. There are boots on the ground for some of the countries in Europe in Ukraine. And a lot of the weapon systems that are used by Ukraine are operated in whole or in part by Western operators. So, for me, I want to say that the United States, Europeans, and their allies bear responsibility for the blood of this innocent life and all the innocent life since 2014 in the Donbass and elsewhere.
One of the things that the UN does is it lists, something like 14,000 killed civilians in this contract, in this conflict as Ukrainians. Mm-hmm. They don't separate whether they're in Russian territories or where they're in Kiev's territories. They just lump them together as Ukrainians to make it look like, it's Russia's fault. They don't separate out who's on which side of the border, who's being killed by whom, in other words.
Of course. And they tried to conceal the fact that the Ukrainian regime has, from the very beginning, used terrorism as an act, as a constant act of violence and aggression towards the people in the Donbass who wanted to have their culture, their values, their traditions, their language, their religion in peace. And the people in Crimea, the people in Kursk then, the people in Belgorod, the people all over, and the people far away who've been targeted by missiles and drones,
yep,
not only in Voronezh and Moscow, but also further afield, you know?
Yeah, like Polish farmers.
Yes. So I think that, you know, at this point, Trump came into office saying no new wars, no endless wars, no regime change wars. We're going to end the war in Ukraine in 24 hours. And we are now in year two of his administration. We're at the midterms, basically. Yep. And we not only do not have a solution, we have an entrenchment of the conflict. And if what I fear comes true, I think we're going to see an escalation if the Democrats come to power either in the midterms, but especially in the next general election.
Oh, I think we're going to have an escalation well before that. I don't think the U.S. is going to fight in Europe, the big war in Europe.
No.
It's going to make money out of it.
Yeah, of course. They're going to send the others to go fight.
Right. I tell people, look, you know, the U.S. has 5,000 M1 and M1A1 tanks parked. And now they're upgrading the M1s to M1A1s. The U.S. has about 6,000 Bradleys parked, old Bradleys. Why would you keep that unless you're planning to sell it to somebody?
Yeah.
I mean, that's 12 armored divisions.
It's a lot of equipment.
It's a lot of equipment. So, you know, I mean, what was it? The Hawkeye, I think is the name of the missile system, anti-aircraft missile system that went out back in 92. And there's hundreds of those that are still kept in working condition. Again, it's a pretty old system. It came in like in the late 60s, early 70s. But again, it's still there. They're not cutting it up for scrap metal.
Nope.
Why would you keep it unless you have plans? Right.
They have plans.
Yeah, you've got 12 armor divisions. Who are you going to sell it to unless you have a big war?
Yeah. Not only that, we have the what is it, the aircraft graveyard, that what they call the bone graveyard in the southwest of the U.S. They're taking planes from there and starting to refurbish them to get them back.
Oh, really?
Yes.
I missed that one.
Yes. During the Iran war, they started to say that we're going to take some planes that were targeted, and other planes that they don't have enough of. They're going to take them from the graveyard there and start bringing them back into service.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, I think the U.S., you know, back when you were still in high school, I was the first time I read an article toward we need another good war, you know, World War II, good war, you know, to get the U.S. economy back up and running, was in 1998. It was Forbes. I'm pretty sure it was Forbes. I may be wrong, but that was 1998. So, you know, if it's coming out in any kind of media, even on that level, that the elites have already been talking about it for a while.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
Big European war. They flat out said we need another big European war where we can then do a new Marshall Plan. We can, you know, write off our debts and become creditors and, you know, rebuild our economy by rebuilding what's left of Europe.
You know, when you look at that and you think about how much money, I mean, we have, as a budget proposal, $1.5 trillion. We were shocked when it went to a trillion. Now we're nearly 1.5, you know, we're going up to 1.5, and then what's next, 2, 3?
But it's much bigger than that.
That's only the Pentagon. Right. Imagine, and what we know, because there's a lot of black budget too.
Budget. That's not even only the Pentagon, because you have Veteran Affairs.
Yeah,
so half a trillion almost.
Yep.
That's normally in any other nation that would be under the Ministry of Defense.
Yeah,
Veteran Affairs. But that in the U.S. is separate. And then when you go down line items, like for example, half the NASA budget is military.
Yeah, for sure.
There was an organization, an NGO. Probably about 7 or 8 years ago, they went line item by line item. And they came out with about 25-26% of GDP, of the U.S. government budget, is military. It's just majority of it is hidden in different line items and under different departments. That was a time, if you remember, there was a big scandal that 200 Hollywood movies were fully funded by the military.
Yeah. Of course.
Including all the Avengers and all that. Their funding came from the military.
And also the support for movies like Top Gun Maverick, where the military was full in on it. And you saw that even the narrative and the arc in the movie is exactly similar to what happened in Iran.
Yep.
Putting it out there. They're not hiding anything.
Oh, yeah. So much for the invisible hand of the market or some other.
Oh, what invisible hand?
Some other crappy. Yeah, I mean, some other silly crap like that for foreigners. Sure, yeah, trust the market.
Yeah.
They bought it.
You know? Well, of course they did. Yeah. We have an orange hand instead, not an invisible hand.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Chris, I know I've held you on for quite a while. I want to thank you. Looking forward to seeing you. Well, next week we'll see each other at the different conferences. So
absolutely. I'm looking forward to it.
Yep, me too. Thank you. Thank you for coming on. And
thank you for having me.
We'll have to... Well, we got a cold spell coming up, but after the cold spell, I have to get back to the Barbie.
For sure, indeed. Thank you again.
And not a blow-up Barbie, the barbecue.
Yes, the barbecue, of course. Come on.
Yeah, got to spell it out for some people. Just, oh, they got a Barbie. Oh, there's some weird people over there. Everybody, thank you. Thank you. And we laugh because the alternative is crying.
Yes, of course. Take care, everyone.
Cheers. Oh, cheers. Before we go, Chris, where can they find you? The people.
So you can find me. I have at Chris Halali on X, Instagram, TikTok, also on YouTube. I have the Christopher Halali Show and also DD Geopolitics, of which I'm a journalist. So follow DD Geopolitics on everywhere. And definitely we'll keep the conversation going. And I'm sure we'll be back on each other's shows very soon.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Everybody, cheers. Thank you for joining.